Good afternoon. You're listening to Unusual Sources on 93.3 CFMU FM. Now, there's a lot in the news right now about the conflict between Georgia and Russia over South Ossetia, and we'll be getting to that today. But first, we're continuing in an important series of interviews about the trial of Bosnian Serb leader Karadzic, a situation very relevant to Georgia today. Our leading guest is Edward S. Herman. Now, Edward S. Herman is a professor emeritus of finance at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He is a prolific author, and together with Noam Chomsky, he developed the propaganda model. This was published in their book, Manufacturing Consent, which explains why the mainstream media serve an elite propaganda function. So in 2000, he and Philip Hammond edited the book Degraded Capability, The Media and the Kosovo Crisis, and this book focused on NATO's motivations in dismantling Yugoslavia and how the media created spin to support NATO's illegal actions. So his work is very foundational among peace activists, and today we're interviewing him about his landmark monthly review article, which was written together with David Peterson. And this article is called The Dismantling of Yugoslavia, a Study in Inhumanitarian Intervention. And so we are very grateful to have this leading analyst in media and political economy on our program today. So, Professor Herman, it's great to have you with us today. So thanks very much for coming on the program today.
My pleasure.
Given what we had been hearing in the trial for Karadzic and the Srebrenica massacre, you have done your own critical investigation that included a look at what happened at Srebrenica versus what the media was saying. In your view, what actually happened at Srebrenica in comparison to the way the media had been reporting on it recently and several years ago?
Well, Srebrenica, the Bosnian Serbs took over the town. It had been supposedly a safe town. The UN had created these safety zones, but these safety zones were supposed to be demilitarized, but they weren't. And in Srebrenica, there were Bosnian Muslim forces led by a man named Nasser Oric that for several years had actually mounted attacks from Srebrenica into the nearby Serb villages and killed very large numbers of people, burned down houses, and really created a tremendous amount of anger. So that eventually when the Bosnian Serbs occupied Srebrenica, they felt pretty vengeful. But exactly what happened is still very controversial. The Bosnian Muslims, of course, claimed that there had been a mass executions. But the famous figure of 8,000 came about because the Red Cross, right at the beginning, announced that there were 8,000 people missing, of which 5,000 had left before the Bosnian Serbs came, and about 5,000. And 3,000 had allegedly been captured by the Bosnian Serbs. One of the miracles of the propaganda operation is that that 8,000 that was based on this initial Red Cross claim has stood with us up to this very moment. Usually, you know, when you have allegations of mass killing, large number of deaths, as in Kosovo, or after 9/11 in New York, subsequently the numbers fall when the records are actually gathered. But it's never happened with regard to the Srebrenica massacre, although this 8,000 figure was a very artificial figure. The 5,000 that had escaped had left before the Bosnian Serbs took over. An awful lot of them got to Bosnian Muslim territory. Quite a few of them were killed in warfare and fighting as they tried to reach Bosnian Muslim territory. And it's really not known with clarity how many of them were executed. In fact, when the Bosnian Serbs came in, it's a well-known fact, well-known among students of this thing, that they bussed the women and children away, and they took a certain number of the Srebrenica males, and those males were taken away to God court claimed that there was, admitted that there were only about 2,000 bodies found. And, of course, all those bodies weren't necessarily executed. So where did the 8,000, how did the 8,000 hold up? Well, it held up because there were allegations that these people were still missing, although the lists were not very clear or accurate. Some of them, it was a mess. So in it's my belief that the 8,000 is a mythical figure, and that probably the number that were literally executed probably are in the hundreds. But you can't contest this. This is a case of where once a propaganda claim is made in a friendly propaganda environment, it can't be dislodged. I mean, it's kind of a miracle of the way the mainstream media can work.
Well, you've actually touched on a number of issues here, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, what NATO was doing. We've had Michael Parenti on the program earlier to talk about why NATO was interested in Yugoslavia, how it wanted to break it up, and how it focused on the Serbs a lot. Would you say that was the case with the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia as well? Was this an unbiased body, or were you saying this is more of a NATO appendage?
Oh, it was absolutely an arm of the NATO powers. It was created by the Security Council under real pressure from the United States and probably West Germany. And the design from the very beginning was to have a quasi-judicial public relations operation that would facilitate NATO's attack on Yugoslavia and dismantlement of Yugoslavia. And there's a wonderful book by a Canadian named Michael Mandel called How America Gets Away with Murder that has a very good discussion of the origins of the tribunal. And in Mandel's theory, which I agree, the function of the tribunal was actually to prevent peace, to focus on the need for justice, and to use that as a means of going after the Serbs until the United States and NATO had achieved its political purposes. And that required war. In fact, the tribunal, the Western powers, were extremely important in preventing a settlement of the disputes in Yugoslavia in 1992-93. There were a whole bunch of attempts to get agreements, like in Lisbon, there was a famous Lisbon agreement that fell apart because the Bosnian Muslims pulled out. And they pulled out at the U.S. recommendation. And so the civil war over territory ensued, in which there were an awful lot of people killed. And a lot of that responsibility has to be given to the Western powers. And the tribunal played a key role here, because they demonized all the Serb leaders, Mladic, Karadzic, Milosevic, and they did it explicitly in the case of Mladic and Karadzic to prevent them from being able to negotiate any settlement. This was true. The Dayton settlement was carried out without those leaders of the Bosnian Serbs present. Milosevic had to do it. So they couldn't go after Milosevic because he was needed to help make that settlement when they wanted to make it in 95. But in any case, the tribunal contributed to the fighting then. And during the war against Kosovo, it played a key role. It didn't oppose the war. And it indicted Milosevic in the middle of the war, just at a time when the NATO powers were starting to bomb civilian facilities. So along comes
Well, there's an old saying that you should follow the money. Who funded the ICTY? Was it the UN? I imagine it wasn't Yugoslavia that funded the ICTY.
No, it wasn't Yugoslavia. It certainly was the Western powers. The United States was a principal contributor, and some of the other Western powers. And they also contributed most of the personnel and vetted the personnel. It's a well-known fact, for example, that the prosecutor Louise Arbour was personally vetted by Madeleine Albright, and so was Del Ponte. So it really was, it was U.S. Western funded and Western supplied with personnel. And in fact, the West also supplied the information. They were sort of the tribunal's police information service. They would go out, capture the war criminals. They would provide the information needed to try them. And when they didn't want to do that, when it was their friends who were committing crimes, for example, the biggest ethnic cleansing in the Yugoslav wars was the Croatian removal of 250,000 Krajina Serbs from Croatia in the summer of 95. It was called Operation Storm. The United States actually helped Croatia do that. So the United States refused to give the tribunal information, photos on what had happened. And they essentially vetoed the prosecution.
Well, it sounds like a very one-sided tribunal. I also got the sense from your article with David Peterson, that the ICTY was only one part of a demonization against the Serbs and Milosevic. You have the media coming in on the other side and portraying it not as a civil war, but as a sort of Serb racial purification campaign.
Yeah, it was, of course, officials also, and the UN, Kofi Annan and the UN leaders became real spokespersons for NATO in this enterprise. But NATO officials and, of course, as you say, the media were extremely important. They got on this bandwagon very early in the 1991-92, and the Serbs became their demons, and they focused almost entirely on the Serbs. And they were very gullible, too. The Bosnian Muslims and U.S. officials found that they could tell fantastic stories, and the media would gobble it up, and they wouldn't check it out. Right off the bat, in 1993, the Muslims claimed that 200 to 250,000 had been killed by the Serbs, and they made claims about huge rape camps, and the media just gobbled this stuff up, and it wasn't true, and there weren't rape camps, and there's absolutely no evidence that the Serbs carried out more rapes than the Croatians or Bosnian Muslims. The 250,000 of 1993 has been totally destroyed by two research studies that were sponsored by one by the tribunal itself, and the other by Norway. So these are really conservative sources. But a couple of years ago, they both came to the conclusion that the total number of deaths on all sides in Bosnia from 92 to 95 was in the order of 100,000, and that maybe about 60 to 70,000 civilians were killed on all sides. But the idea that there was genocide in Bosnia has been institutionalized. And it's quite mind-boggling.
It sounds like we're dealing with distortions of weapons of mass destruction proportions.
Oh, yeah, the analogy there is pretty good. I mean, the official claims are swallowed with amazing ease by the mainstream media. The weapons of mass destruction, Iran about to get a nuclear bomb or bombs. I think the media actually has somewhat deteriorated over the years. It's become more centralized and more commercialized. And, of course, governments have become much more sophisticated in their public relations. They're able to establish bandwagons very easily. You know, some years back, Reagan was trying to demonize the Soviet Union, that the evil empire was behind it, that the Bulgarians and the KGB had done it. And it took no time for the media to swallow this, and no other viewpoint was allowed for years. It was all completely phony. This fascist had done it on his own or with the support of his fellow fascists.
The same sort of nonsense seems to be floated around about Georgia right now, and we're going to get to that in the program, but I just wanted to let our listeners who are just tuning in know that we're speaking with Professor Edward S. Herman. We're speaking about his article in Monthly Review about the dismantling of Yugoslavia by NATO. And thank you, Edward. You've mentioned the United Nations a few times, and I thought we should address that a little bit, because in your article you talk about the change in the United Nations that the United States was pushing for during its interventions in Yugoslavia. So throughout the Bosnia and then Kosovo, the U.S. was trying to change things. So what were they pushing the U.N., and what direction are we going here?
Well, this, I think, really dates back to the fall of the Soviet Union, because that left the United States so powerful that it and its allies were able to manage the U.N. much, much more efficiently and have it serve their purposes. And this was certainly true in the Yugoslav wars. In fact, in his autobiography, Richard Holbrooke, who was the U.S. Liaison negotiating in Yugoslavia, he indicated that Kofi Annan got his job as head of the U.N. because in the absence of his boss, Petros Ghali, he actually sanctioned the NATO bombing of the Bosnian Serbs. And so in his autobiography, Holbrooke says, that won him his job. That's, I think, a rather dramatic point, that Holbrooke is really saying that here a guy who was willing to accommodate the U.S. use of violence would they get a job? We would make that clear. And in fact, Kofi Annan was very important in rationalizing everything that the West did in Yugoslavia, and in rationalizing the idea that humanitarian intervention by force was a good idea. He was quite explicit about this, that people who could do the intervening should be doing it in order to protect. There's a need to protect people. So this was a really quite important development, because one of the important things about the UN Charter is it's based on the idea of the protection of the sovereign rights of nations. And this whole idea of humanitarian intervention and the need to protect really flies in the face of that idea. It's really saying that if people in a state are being abused according to the representations in the West can go in and protect those people. That's really, it throws out an extremely important part of the UN Charter and opens the road to what you have to call imperialist interventionism. Who is it that decides who needs to protect? I mean, don't the Kurds in Turkey need to be protected? I mean, while we were intervening in Yugoslavia, Turkey was doing some pretty horrible things to its Kurds. But there was no attempt to get any intervention to protect those Kurds. In fact, the United States was supplying the Turks with arms. And elsewhere in the world, too, there's no need. The United States has regularly prevented any UN monitors from going into Palestine to monitor what was happening there is between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The Israelis don't want it. The United States is protecting Israel, not protecting innocent people in Palestine. So this has been a very ominous development. I'm against humanitarian intervention because it's so easily corruptible. And it means rushing in to protect the South Ossetians.
That's just it. This is the world that we've created now, isn't it? Because getting rid of the idea of international law and sovereignty and borders makes it easy to enter into areas based on the idea of someone's human rights, that we should ignore all those 50 years of the UN Charter and international law and just start intervening because people are getting hurt somewhere.
Yeah, I think, and you're good to mention international law, because international law and the fundamental aspect and feature of the UN Charter is the illegality of crossing borders without, and except in self-defense, or except when the Security Council permits this. So we're talking, when we talk about intervening, humanitarian intervention allegedly to protect human rights, there's a question of what happens to international law. And then, of course, as I say, there's the question of who determines whose human rights are being violated and what is to protect the people who are being attacked from being attacked with excessive violence.
I just wanted to get back to some of the discussions of Serb actions for a moment, because there was some very rich material in your article that really encourages people to change the way they thought about the conflict. For example, when the media was talking about ethnic cleansing, they would portray it as Serb ethnic cleansing, but you say Serbia did not even ethnically cleanse itself. So how did the ethnic cleansing play out as far as you saw it in that conflict?
Well, I think the ethnic cleansing flowed from the fact that there was a question of who would rule in Bosnia and how the parts of Bosnia would be controlled. Once the Bosnia was permitted to get independent, the Serbs didn't like that, and the Croats didn't like that. The Bosnian Muslims wanted to control the whole. So that opened the door to each group trying to claim, get hold of land, so that when a settlement finally did take place, they would control a lot of land. And so that to control this land, they pushed other people out and sometimes killed them, but usually they just mainly pushed them out. So the ethnic cleansing, in my opinion, flowed from the refusal to settle, the granting of Bosnia the right to be independent, even though the various parts didn't want that, only the Muslims did, and the failure to settle. That opened the road to ethnic cleansing. And in Croatia, the Croatians didn't want the Serbs to remain in Croatia. Therefore, they pushed them out. The point that you were referring to, we make this point in our article, that I don't think it's been made in the mainstream media ever. The claim was that the Serbs want to create an ethnically pure Serbia. And so that's why they were ethnically cleansing in Bosnia. But a problem arises because in Serbia itself, nobody was chased out. The Serbs in Serbia never engaged in ethnic cleansing in Serbia. Now, how in heaven's name would that be if they were trying to ethnically purify and create a greater Serbia that only had Serbs? I mean, I think that's a very important proof that whole scheme is a big lie. And, of course, in our article, we argue that the greater Serbia notion, the idea that Milosevic was trying for greater Serbia, is one of the big lies of modern times, because from the beginning he was trying to preserve Yugoslavia. When he couldn't do that, he tried to help the Serbs that were stranded elsewhere to remain with Serbia in some kind of rump Yugoslavia. So the idea that he was trying to create a new, greater Serbia is complete nonsense. He was trying to preserve Yugoslavia, and if he couldn't, he was trying to help all the Serbs be in one territory. So if that's the idea of greater Serbia, it's straight out of George Orwell.
In regards to this these alleged agendas of ethnic cleansing, the ICTY, the tribunal, was focusing a lot on the Serbs. But it seemed that when Milosevic was actually tried, they really couldn't find a lot to pin on him. They couldn't find plans for ethnic cleansing. They couldn't find motives. So all they could refer to was a speech, which they said was a nationalist speech in which he talked about nationalism and dividing it. But you looked at that speech as well. So, again, this is a case of media distortion?
Oh, it's a fantastic case. I mean, actually, the ICTY did try to claim that Milosevic was responsible for the deaths that occurred in Yugoslavia. There were a lot of people killed, but of course, they were never able to produce, I don't think, one document where he actually instructed anybody to kill civilians. Getting to that speech, there was speech, actually there were two speeches, one in 1987 and one in 1989, in which allegedly he aroused the nationalist fervor and opened the doors to nationalist struggle and ethnic cleansing. Well, if you read those speeches, they're actually speeches where he calls for a multi-ethnic Yugoslavia, and he calls for mutual toleration. It's absolutely amazing to read those speeches because there is not one word. I mean, he does, in the 87 speech, he does say that he would protect the Serbs because that speech was given in a place where Serbs had just been attacked. But he repeats in both speeches that nationalism is bad and that we want a multi-ethnic and tolerant Yugoslavia. And in fact, there was one article which pointed out that the BBC had translated the speech and actually commented on the tolerance of the speech. But that was in 1989. But then some years later, when the party line hardened, you know, when he was effectively demonized, the BBC itself talked about this nationalist speech that called for it, that led to ethnic cleansing. And it's an amazing story. Because here they translated it correctly, interpreted it correctly in 89. Then when the party line firms up, they actually rejected their own translation and interpretation at the time in order to play the demonization game.
Well, I'm very interested in how that works, because in your article you wrote about how certain personalities who were looking for intervention by NATO in Yugoslavia were trying to get into the media, to talk to the media, to encourage the media to see things a certain way. Was there a campaign among individuals to sort of sway the media and make them change their position?
Certainly all the officials were doing that, but it is an important fact that both the Bosnian Muslims and the Croatians were much smarter than the Serbs in terms of public relations. Both of them hired American PR firms, and these firms were very shrewd in issuing public releases to the media and making exaggerated claims and taking stories that were sometimes untrue and passing them on, and the media would swallow these stories. And of course there were a lot of individuals who became campaigners. We do discuss some of the people who gathered in Sarajevo and really became virtual spokespersons for the Bosnian Muslims. And they were open campaigners. They were campaigning for war, and they were looking for stories that would demonize the Serbs and put the Muslims in a good light. And in the process, one thing that I find is very intriguing is that they all the Sarajevo journalists who were the campaigners, they all swallowed the idea that the Bosnian Muslim government was a tolerant government. It was wanted a multi-ethnic operation. But they all had to neglect the fact that the head of the government is Begovic. And premier that the state that he wants to run is not going to tolerate minorities. You have people like David Reif and Ed Kuviani claiming that the Bosnian Muslim government was a really tolerant government. It was an amazing phenomenon.
You know, based on what you said about the PR campaigns and how the Bosnians, Muslims, and the Croatians had better PR than the Serbs, it just strikes me that it seems that all of the NATO allies and or, you know, the useful victims that they use to justify interventions, they all seem to have good PR. The Kuwait has had that organization. Then you have those cases in Yugoslavia, Iraqi exiles. And today it seems we've got in Georgia has great PR. Shakir Saveli, the president of Georgia, he's always on CNN almost every hour during the time of the fighting. It seems they've always got a voice. They always have something to say, and they're ready to present it, even if countries like Russia or Serbia aren't.
Yeah, well, the Russians is trying. I think you're making a very good point there, though, that they do seem to be more sophisticated and put more money into it. I think in part it's because they're advised by the United States, which is the fatherland of public relations and advertising. And we have, and of course it's also greatly helped by the fact that the media in the West are so receptive. I mean, CNN, as you say, they're willing to take on the spokespersons for Georgia at any moment of time, and they're not very critical. This was also true during the Yugoslav War. CNN was remarkably gullible. In fact, there was the concept of the CNN effect. There's such a concept, and I think it may have developed during the Yugoslav Wars, and it's referring to the fact that the outfit like CNN, focusing intensively on some subject, may actually have political force. It may actually influence governments by showing trains of refugees and focus on victims of the enemy. It can arouse a lot of emotion. This was fantastic during the Yugoslav Wars and the Kosovo War. When it was over, the press rushed in looking for bodies and rape victims, and this was all true in the Bosnian Wars too. So it's partly the U.S. skill, and it's also partly the U.S. media that is willing to play this victimology and stir up a lot of hostility toward our enemies in that way.
You've really shown that there's a big discrepancy between what the media says and what likely happened on the ground in cases like Yugoslavia and elsewhere. So before we go today, I just wanted to know, is there anything you wanted to say to our listeners and to people out there who are activists and involved in things, just in terms of, you know, what to watch out for in terms of what the media or international tribunals are saying generally?
Well, you have to be very careful from the beginning. You have to realize that the mainstream media is really very, very often a propaganda organ of the state or powerful groups within the state. So you have to be on the alert all the time, and you have to use the internet, and you have to read dissident publications with great care. I mean, but the first rule of understanding the way the world works now is skepticism about the media and a very energetic pursuit of alternative media sources and alternate sites.
Well, certainly for those listeners who have not yet had the chance, I would highly recommend starting out with Edward S. Herman and David Peterson's article on Monthly Review Zine, which is called The Dismantling of Yugoslavia, A Study in Inhumanitarian Intervention and a Western Liberal Left Intellectual Moral Collapse. Now, you can just find that if you Google Edward S. Herman together with words like intellectual and moral collapse. It will give you that Monthly Review article. It'll pop up right there. Often you have to pay for these, but this is an easily accessible and excellent overview of that whole media and actual conflict in Yugoslavia. So, Professor Herman, I wanted to thank you again very much for coming on our program today.
My pleasure. don't forget to mention also they should look at manufacturing consent, which is a 202 edition. That is sort of very fundamental background analysis with case studies that will, are pretty enlightening, I think.
Indeed, it's a very fundamental work, a foundational work for understanding the media.